This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalist Michaela Wrong has witnessed what happens under a dictatorship when the rule of law falls apart and anarchy and absurdity take over. That's what she found in the Congo. She says that under the rule of Mobutu Sese Seko, it became a paradigm of all that was wrong in post-colonial Africa. She's been reporting from there on and off since 1994, when the country was still known as Zaire. The Congo is still in chaos. Mobutu was overthrown in 1997 by Laurent Kabila. Kabila was assassinated early this year and replaced by his son Joseph. Michaela Wrong now writes for the Financial Times and has also reported for Reuters and the BBC. Her new book is called In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz, Living on the Brink of Disaster in Mobutu's Congo. She told me some of the things that had gone wrong under Mobutu.
Well, I think the obvious things are that corruption was absolutely rife. I mean, it was a byword for sleaze, the whole country. And then you have a sort of non-functioning state system in which civil servants sort of receive $8 a month for their salaries or don't get paid at all. Then you have an army which is preying upon the public instead of protecting them. It's the one force that everyone is terrified of is their own army. They think they're going to go berserk. They hold people up at roadblocks. And then you have an economic system that's just sort of collapsed and a place where private companies don't want to go and invest. People don't have decent health services or education. Those are all the elements that I sort of think of as a typical failing state in Africa, and they were very much present in Congo Zaire.
You say that no other president had plundered his economy as effectively or lived the high life to such excess. You credit Mobutu with being the inventor of modern kleptocracy. What was his approach to plundering his own economy?
Well, I think Mobutu's approach to the economy was essentially the approach of a sort of child in a sweet shop, where he just took and took and took, but he didn't understand, and this was something that none of his officials seemed to understand either, that something like a copper industry will not continue to function unless you invest in it and you train people and you get new equipment and you spend a bit of money. So if you just take and take and take, in the end, it just collapses. And of course, in Mobutu's case, there was this element of extraordinary greed where the proceeds of the copper industry and the diamond mining industry, they were just going straight into his private bank account.
In 1994, when you first went to Zaire, which was later renamed the Congo, the government and the infrastructure had already collapsed, and people were virtually living in anarchy. The health care system, the education system, social security, the post office, rule of law had all virtually collapsed. And you say that when the infrastructure gave out, systems were put in place, some of which only the rich could use, like a new telephone system. Would you describe that new telephone system? This will give us a sense of what it was like.
Yes, I mean, I think now we're so used to mobile phones, but when I went out in 94, certainly in Britain, nobody was using them, and most European countries certainly weren't either. And I was astonished to see that there was this extremely effective, very efficient system of mobile phones in Kinshasa being used by the elite. It was called Telecel, and it had been set up by an American who had realised that basically nobody could communicate with each other because the state system had crumbled away. It had been installed by the Belgians, never maintained, the landlines were corroding, and they were also being cannibalised by people who had sort of cut up the wire and sell it. So he had set up this mobile phone system. And I always thought it was very, it was a real insight into Zaire, because if you could afford to, you could buy your way out of chaos. So, you know, the roads were falling apart. So people had four-wheel drive. The water was contaminated. You drink mineral water. I mean, there was always this sort of sense that there was a class of hugely rich people who could just, you know, sidestep the whole thing.
Did you ever meet President Mobutu when he was alive?
I never had a sort of one-on-one interview, but I was sort of around, you know, I sort of followed him on walkabout around the airport and sort of, you know, he was sort of with his cane, which was supposed to be a magic cane, and he was lifting it above his head and walking around with his wife, walking around the airport and then holding press conferences. But by the time I got there, he'd become almost a recluse. I mean, he spent very little time in the capital. He was up in the jungle estate he had, the Palace of Badalita, Alicante, which was a good 2 hours flight away. So he was a difficult man to get to see. He was afraid. He thought he'd be assassinated if he spent too much time in Kinshasa.
Mobutu often looked really kind of ridiculous in photos. Would you describe his look?
Well, I mean, he never really got over the 1970s. He had invented this jacket called the abacost, which meant it stood for abat le costume, as in down with the suit, because it was supposed to be a revolt against Western sort of colonialization. And he was very fond of that jacket. And he, although it used to be obligatory for all Zairians to wear it, and then he sort of dropped, that was dropped when they introduced multi-party democracy. But he sort of liked to wear it anyway. So he did look like somebody from the 1970s who'd been transported to the 1990s, definitely.
And didn't he sometimes wear like a pillbox hat?
Oh, yes. I mean, there was always that. I think if you look at African dictators, they always have a sort of symbol that they like to attach themselves to that makes them instantly recognisable. It's as though they don't have the self-confidence to really believe in the power they have. They have to have a symbol of their power to show around that this is me, you know, that I am the king. And with him, you know, there were the heavy sunglasses, the heavy black-rimmed glasses, the pillbox leopard skin hat, and the cane. Those were the key three items.
Was President Mobutu popular in the Congo? He had stolen his country's riches. He had created anarchy throughout the country. Did people like him?
Well, I think he went through an extraordinary sort of rise and fall in popularity. By the time I got there, he was loathed, and he was regarded almost, I mean, it was a sort of, he had a satanic type of stature. I mean, anything that went wrong, anything that any sort of appalling event that happened, it was Mobutu was behind it. Even if you couldn't really see a link, then everybody blamed it on him. And I think the diplomats had a bit of the same tendency. I mean, he was regarded as this sort of evil genius behind everything. But if you go back and you find out and you talk to people about the 1960s, he took power twice, 1960, he then handed over to a civilian government, 1965, he came and he was there to stay. And really, he was enormously popular because they had had a series of disastrous years in which they had civilian politicians who'd been scratching each other's eyes out. They'd been a state, the army had mutinied. There was a sense that the country, there'd been secession attempts. The country seemed to be falling apart. Then there was this young guy who was simple, who was forceful, who was brave, who brought the army under control. He was enormously popular. They were very grateful for him taking over. And he maintained that for quite a long time. He was a very gifted public speaker. I've spoken to Zairians who went and listened to his speeches, and they said, you know, rather in the way that Hitler used to kind of charm his audience, only Mobutu did it with humour. He would crack jokes. He was very clever at using the local Lingala language. He would sort of humiliate ministers that were unpopular already in public. He'd get them on stage and sort of make fun of them. And he would seduce the crowd. And that effect really did last for a very, very long time until the economy started to go into recession and he became afraid of his own population.
What part did America play in putting Mobutu in power and keeping him there?
Well, Mobutu had been talent spotted very early on in Brussels when he'd been there with Patrice Lumumba, who was the prime minister of the time. And the CIA had spotted him and thought, this guy is really promising. And Patrice Lumumba was sort of flirting with the Soviet Union, showed rather worrying communist tendencies. So they had sort of decided that Mobutu was their man. And definitely there was more than a nod and the wink and that he was getting sort of financial help from various embassies during those years when he was just head of the army. But really, I think the US's role in keeping Mobutu in power was it stretched over decades rather than just those years after independence because they were always there to hold his hand. He was taking tea at the White House. They were sending money through Zaire into Angola, so they needed Mobutu as a friend. So there was the funding going through. Then there was the US influence on the World Bank and the IMF. They made sure that both institutions kept lending to Mobutu. 1942, he had an incredibly powerful friend there, a friend who made sure that Western troops would be sent in when it looked like that there were going to be secession attempts on Zaire. So it stretched on really for decades.
My guest is journalist Michaela Wrong. We'll talk more about the Congo after a break. This is Fresh Air. Michaela Wrong is my guest. She's a journalist whose new book is called In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz, Living on the Brink of Disaster in Mobutu's Congo, and she's been covering the Congo off and on since 1994. How was Mobutu overthrown?
Well, it's a long story, but essentially there was a rebel movement propped up by Rwanda and Uganda in the east that rose up and marched on all the way to Kinshasa. And what was sort of amazing was that people like myself, journalists and diplomats, were saying, well, you know, they say they're going to march on Kinshasa, they'll never get there. You know, have you seen the distances? Have you seen the state of the roads? And frankly, you know, there is still an army in Zaire which will stop them. And what happened was that the Zairean army sort of evaporated. They just never fought a battle. All they did was they retreated and they would rape and loot the villages as they went back. And the whole sort of army imploded, and the rebels just marched into Kinshasa. I was there when that happened, and everybody had been expecting an absolute bloodletting. And in fact, it was very peaceful because at the last moment, Mobutu's presidential guards, who everyone had expected to make a sort of massive last stand in Kinshasa, they just changed into tracksuits, got rid of their uniforms, and took the boat out of Kinshasa to Brazzaville. And so the city was largely won without almost a shot being fired.
Where were you when Mobutu was overthrown?
Well, I was in a hotel with a lot of other journalists in Kinshasa watching these presidential guards, because it turned out that the hotel we were staying in, the Intercontinental, we hadn't realized it. We decided to go there because we thought it would be the safest place to be, so that we could, because it's right next to the river. So we thought we would be able to run to the embassies, which were on the riverbank. And we knew that they had high-powered boats and that we'd be able to get out if necessary, if things really turned nasty. And what we discovered on the day that the rebels marched in was that, in fact, Mobutu's presidential guards had all been staying in our hotel, or at least they'd been putting up their families there, and therefore they were using it as a rallying point. And so there was a rather sort of unpleasant couple of hours where we were looking out of the window and seeing all these men with Kalashnikovs and rounds of cartridges draped around their shoulders, and wondering if they were going to make a last stand in our hotel, and that we'd in fact picked the worst possible place to be in the capital. But what happened, as I said, was that they went through instead. They had it all planned. They weren't going to fight. They didn't think it was worth it. And they just changed into tracksuits. So none of them, suddenly they went from being, you know, military men to being civilians. And they took their families, their wives and their children and their luggage, and just walked to the river, got in boats and got out of there. And that was it.
What's it like to stay in one place to cover a story like that, when I think the natural impulse would be to flee?
Well, I think that the trouble is, I at the time I was working for the Financial Times newspaper, and they were saying, we would like you to leave. And without sort of staging a massive showdown about it, I was saying, I really don't want to go. And I think that you're so intellectually curious to know the end of the story. You know, you feel that you've seen something of what was there at the start. You want to see it through. You just don't want to miss that. So in the end, it's much harder to tear yourself away. And I'm so grateful that I didn't leave then, because I just wanted to be there.
Was that a frightening time when people were running around drunk and looting? Did you feel in danger covering that?
Well, I think there was a sense that there were a couple of hours where the whole thing could have got completely out of control. But what happened was that what we understand happened was that the embassies, the Western embassies, who were in touch with Kabila, who was the head of the rebel movement, actually sort of phoned him and said, get a move on, get into Kinshasa fast. Mobutu has left. He's taken the plane to Badalite. You've got to get in there fast. And they were saying, but our forces are completely exhausted. And they said, well, you know, please speed it up, because they were still walking. And I think the most dangerous point in a city is when you have one you know, power is moving out, and another power hasn't yet come in, and it only lasted a couple of hours. So there was the looting began, but it was stopped pretty soon.
And what changed when Laurent Kabila took over?
Well, essentially, this is what's so depressing, because I think Kabila ended up making Mobutu look very good, because he wasn't capable of changing the system. He wasn't capable of relaunching the economy, which was desperately needed. And then he ended up having a second rebel uprising against him, organised also by Rwanda and Uganda behind these rebel movements. So essentially very, very soon he was in even more desperate straits than Mobutu, with half of his country out of control, half of the country being held by these various rebel movements. And he was bartering off and selling off all sorts of state assets, resources, mineral resources to Zimbabwe, Angola and Namibia. So Kabila made Mobutu look good, which at the time, we didn't think was possible.
Laurent Kabila was assassinated at the beginning of this year. His son took over. Is anything different now?
Well, I get the impression that everyone is hoping that what Laurent Kabila didn't achieve, you know, Joseph Kabila can begin to do more seriously. And the priority, obviously, is to stop the civil war. But I'm a little wary. I think it's not clear to me that he can deliver. He's under 30 years old. He's completely dependent on Angolan and Zimbabwean forces to stay in power. And I don't think the corrupt figures that were behind Laurent Kabila, his father, have gone away. So they're going to be wanting to stay in Kinshasa, make a lot of money from the mineral resources, and they haven't disappeared. So I'm very dubious about this whole new regime.
What's the state of the civil war now in the Congo?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, with Joseph Kabila coming into power, there's been a new sort of impetus for peace. It's been very much encouraged by the US and Belgium and Germany, Britain are all sort of saying, let's really sit down, let's get this Lusaka peace process, which had been suspended under Laurent Kabila, let's get it so that it's effective. And we have had some troops being pulled back. Uganda in particular has been pulling back troops. So I think there is hope, but I'm a little worried that the hope is not going to be fulfilled.
I think there's a big debate that continues to go on about how much of Africa's problems in the states in which there are great problems can be attributed to colonial rule, and how much of the responsibility African leaders have to take on themselves and African people have to take on themselves. The Congo is an interesting place because of the rule of King Leopold of Belgium, a very kind of corrupt and terrorizing rule. Tell us a little bit about his rule in the colonial era.
Well, yes, I think if you look at Congo's history, it's been brutalized time and time again. And I used to find, you know, that when I got there, I used to be so exasperated by the sort of what seemed to be the political passivity, which was the political passivity of the local people. And then, you know, when I was researching the book, it was really the moment where I began to think, my God, you know, I'm amazed that they're even as gumptious and as enterprising as they are, because you'd had slavery, and you must never forget, I mean, Central Africa was devastated by that experience of the slave traders from Eastern Africa. And then in the wake of that, very soon after that, you had King Leopold's rule, which was probably the most brutal rule on the African continent. I mean, he was after rubber because the pneumatic tire was about to become the great Western product, and there was wild rubber in abundance in Congo, and he wanted it, and he used the most brutal techniques to get it out of Congo. The sort of famous pictures that came back after a couple of years were pictures of people, baskets full of severed hands. And these were the hands of villagers, because Leopold's mercenaries would just go in there. And if a village hadn't come up with its rubber quota, then the young men would have their hands chopped off and they would be taken back. And they would show these to the Belgian officials to show that they had done their job properly. And it's absolutely, if you think of that sort of taking place year in, year out, there were millions of orphans being created, the areas of Congo that were being burnt down and just sort of razed to the ground by these mercenary troops that he had recruited. It's absolutely devastating. And I think you can never forget that when you wonder why, Congo Zaire is the way it is today. That just left such a deep imprint on people's collective memories.
Well, Makela Rong, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Makela Rong is the author of the new book, In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz, Living on the Brink of Disaster in Mobutu's Congo. This is Fresh Air.